today at Reader's Corner, Stephen F. Knott, author of Coming to Terms with John F. Kennedy. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. My guest today has spent his life grappling with the legacy of America's 35th president. In his latest book, Coming to Terms with John F. Kennedy, American political scientist Stephen F. Knott offers a nuanced assessment of the young president whose legacy and impact people continue to debate to this day. He examines Kennedy through the lens of five critical issues: his interpretation of presidential power, his approach to civil rights, his foreign policy toward Cuba and the Soviet Union, Vietnam, and his assassination. Stephen Knott is an emeritus professor of national security affairs at the United States Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. His essays have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Time, Politico, and elsewhere. He is the author-editor of 10 books dealing with the American presidency, the early republic, and American foreign policy. Stephen Knott, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to our discussion.
Well, let's kick off the discussion, Steve, with your roots, so to speak. In a sense, this is a book about returning to your roots, both family roots and also professional roots, to the extent that once upon a time you worked for the Kennedy Library.
That's right, Bob. Yeah, I grew up in an Irish Catholic family in Massachusetts, which, of course, was Kennedy Central. And for my mother, when John F. Kennedy broke that religious barrier that had kept any non-Protestant out of the White House, from that point on, he could do no wrong. So I inherited that sort of saintly take on John F. Kennedy. And my two earliest memories as a human being, the first is the Cuban Missile Crisis, and seeing the fear on my parents' faces as they watched President Kennedy in October of 62 talk about the fact that the Soviets had placed these nuclear weapons in Cuba. That was the first time I'd ever seen that look of fear. And then a little over a year later, I came home from the first grade, and my mother was seated in front of this grainy black and white television, and she was watching the news from Dallas, Texas, that President Kennedy had been assassinated. And again, those events coupled with this worshipful approach, particularly on the part of my mother towards President Kennedy, I had inherited all of that. And I just thought it was time, now that decades and decades we're removed from the Kennedy presidency, that I go back and look at the first president that I can remember.
And you did an excellent job of that. I want to say, I think the scholarship of your book is just excellent. And it's amazing that it's such a crowded field of work. I think you point out somewhere in your introduction that over 40,000 books on Kennedy and the era. Is that right?
That's correct. Now, a number of those deal with the assassination, which has become, you know, kind of a separate industry unto itself. But yes, Kennedy was president for only 2 years, 10 months, and 2 days. And yet that brief period of time has generated a remarkable amount of scholarship and popular work on this presidency. And that's part of the reason I wanted to go back and take a look as to why this president, who had such a brief tenure of office, had such a hold on the American imagination.
Well, let's start with what you call the expansive concept of the presidency he had. And when you discuss that, you also talk about the fact that, of course, he was the master of the medium. Please explain.
Sure. So President Kennedy had, shall we say, inherited the progressive view of the presidency that was sort of laid down by both Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and put into practice by Franklin Roosevelt. And this was the notion, as Woodrow Wilson liked to put it, that the president should be as big a man as he wants to be. So Wilson laid down the markers, well, not really any markers, because it was kind of a boundless interpretation of presidential power. John F. Kennedy believed in that interpretation. And he used, as you mentioned in your question, he uses television to such a remarkable effect that I think even Woodrow Wilson might have been shocked at the extent to which Kennedy was able to ingratiate himself with the American people through this new medium that Kennedy was perfectly suited for. Good looks, quick wit, great hair, something I've always been jealous of. Just the master of television.
It was intellect, it was wit, and he did a lot of homework, it seems. I mean, the guy never stood before the cameras without knowing exactly where he was going.
That's absolutely true, Bob, and I'm glad you raised that point. I certainly don't want to leave the impression that Kennedy was something of an empty suit and was just perfect for this new medium of television. He actually was, in my view, a remarkably smart individual, a quick study. He loved to read. He was constantly reading historical biographies. He also liked to read the occasional James Bond novel. Very quick study. And that comes through. Your listeners can access all of Kennedy's press conferences on YouTube. And he was remarkably quick. And he decided to conduct those things live, which had never been done before. And it was a real roll of the dice, because if the president flubs a question, that can have real ramifications, not only at home in the United States, but around the globe. But the guy was just very substantive, in addition to having those sort of superficial qualities that made him something of a star for TV.
I must say that I liked the way you inserted a number of his funniest lines that really do make the reader laugh every now and then as you're reading through this thing. I mean, the self-deprecating humor you mentioned toward the end of the book, he was referring to his wartime heroics, where, of course, he commanded the PT-109 and it sank. And he says about his heroics, it was involuntary. They sank my boat. And that's just one of a number of those that you share with the reader that I think really keeps the book alive and so interesting. Let's move right on to how the conventional narrative overstates the charge that Kennedy was indifferent to civil rights. I think involved in this area of study is what you call the most important speech of his presidency.
Absolutely, Bob. The president delivers a nationwide television address in June of 1963, in which he puts the full weight of his office behind what will become the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Now, you hinted at this in your question. There were a lot of critics who felt that Kennedy was too cautious, came to the civil rights agenda with some reluctance out of a fear of alienating powerful Southern segregationist members of Congress, who, by the way, happened to be members of his own party. And there is some justification for that. But I believe in the end, in the final months of his life, Kennedy embraces civil rights, embraces the agenda of Dr. King. And that June 1963 television address on civil rights, I think, is one of the most moving addresses ever delivered by an American president. And again, this is something your listeners can access on YouTube. Now, let me just mention, Bob, Kennedy also did show some courage regarding civil rights during the 1960 campaign against Richard Nixon. And I'm referring to when Dr. Martin Luther King was arrested in Albany, Georgia, taken away in the middle of the night, and Mrs. King, Coretta Scott King, had no idea where the Georgia authorities were taking her husband. And of course, it wasn't unusual at this time for law enforcement in the South to hand people over to the Ku Klux Klan or other white supremacist organizations. So Mrs. King was frantic. She appealed to both Vice President Nixon and Senator Kennedy to intervene on her husband's behalf. And only one of those two candidates did so, and that was John F. Kennedy. And he did so, by the way, at some political risk, because again, he was also counting on the support of white Southern Democrats.
So Kennedy beats Nixon and the Republicans in 60 by claiming they were soft on communism. So how does that set up how Kennedy handles Cuba? And of course, anybody who knows anything about the Kennedy years knows that the Bay of Pigs was just his disaster. But please explain.
Sure. So Kennedy, I would argue and do argue in the book, boxes himself in by some very hawkish rhetoric in that 1960 campaign. He's one of the few mid to late 20th century Democrats that manages to outmaneuver or outflank his Republican opponent on national security. Kennedy actually takes a tougher line. And as you mentioned, Bob, Kennedy is very critical of Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon for allowing Cuba to go communist on their watch. And in a way, he's doing what the Republicans had done with Harry Truman by accusing Truman of losing China. Kennedy is accusing Nixon and Eisenhower of losing Cuba to the communists. So it isn't very specific, but he does say or suggest that is not going to be tolerated under a Kennedy administration. And of course, that's the beginning of the road to the Bay of Pigs fiasco, which Kennedy gives the green light to, an invasion of anti-Cuban exiles designed to overthrow Castro. It's a complete failure. He accepts full responsibility for it, but he also intensifies his efforts to get rid of Castro through more covert means. So Kennedy's policies on Cuba remain to this day, I would say, perhaps one of the more controversial elements of his legacy.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Stephen F. Knott, author of Coming to Terms with John F. Kennedy. And share with us Operation Mongoose, what that was and why that spends the rest of his life hanging over him.
So Operation Mongoose was the code name given to a CIA effort, Central Intelligence Agency effort, to overthrow the Castro regime through primarily economic sabotage, but also through an assassination campaign designed to eliminate Fidel Castro. And President Kennedy puts his brother Robert, the Attorney General, in charge of Operation Mongoose. This happens after the Bay of Pigs. So there's no paring back on this effort to remove Castro. I think President Kennedy believed that he had made this commitment in the 1960 campaign. He had to deliver on it. And with that said, about eight different assassination attempts, at least eight, there could have been more, sponsored by the CIA, all of which failed. But these were all undertaken during the Kennedy years, which, by the way, is going to feed this notion, perhaps, that President Kennedy himself was the victim of a conspiracy that the Cubans might have played some role in. I'll just add one other quick point, Bob. I think in his heart of hearts, Kennedy knew that this obsession, he even used that term, with Cuba was somewhat unhealthy and was distorting America's foreign policy. But again, you know, that's not an attempt to excuse the fact that what he attempted to do against Castro was pretty ruthless. It failed, and you could make, I think, a pretty strong case that it tarnished America's reputation in the international community.
There's a new book out on Frank Church and his 1975 hearings on the CIA. I'm sure you're aware of it. But in that book, there's some detail about the CIA and the mob working together to assassinate Castro. And I mean, it really sounds like Jimmy Breslin's book, The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight, pretty much sums it up. But again, we go on. I want to make sure that we cover the material in your book. Let's talk about the missile gap issue. Kennedy made the charge over and over again that Eisenhower allowed us to fall behind the Russians. And of course, Sputnik didn't do any favors there in that regard as well. But as it turns out, and this is an interesting part of your book, it all depends on where you get your information from. And in this particular case, Kennedy made the charge, but it's like, where were the facts coming from? And today, when we're spending so much time debating what's real and what's not, it's kind of interesting that even back then, you didn't know for sure.
Yeah, great question, Bob. So Kennedy's based his allegation on a missile gap. In other words, the Soviets, Kennedy alleged, were moving ahead of us in missile technology, the Sputnik success being the most prominent example of Soviet prowess in terms of the exploration of space. But also the fear was that their intercontinental ballistic missiles were ahead of ours, were better technically and could deliver more firepower. This was based, Kennedy's allegation was based on a report called the Gaither Report that was actually commissioned by President Eisenhower. So the actual initial source of this allegation was from within the Eisenhower presidency. So I do think there's a tendency of critics of President Kennedy who accuse him of lying about the missile gap to ignore the fact that it was the Republican administration's report that first laid this out for the American public. Now, Kennedy, to his credit, I would argue, when he becomes president, he orders Secretary of Defense McNamara to conduct a review about this allegation. What were the roots of it? And is there anything to it? And in the end, McNamara and his report conclude there is nothing to it. In fact, the United States is well ahead of the Soviet Union, at least when it comes to intercontinental ballistic missiles. And Kennedy accepts that report. And I would say even more importantly, Bob, Kennedy's the one who asks the Pentagon to carry out this report. And this is one of the things I admire about John F. Kennedy. I think he did have a very inquisitive mind. He was very willing to challenge even his own pronouncements if presented with the facts. And that's something, that's a quality I wish we would see in more American presidents.
Well, you know, it's interesting when we're here talking about a missile gap and he's charging that we're behind, fast forward in his brief presidency, and you come to June of 1963 when he delivers this speech at American University, and you can share with our listeners what happens from them. But that's a pretty interesting moment of prediction.
Very interesting moment. I think both President Kennedy and Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev looked into the abyss, so to speak, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And both were looking out of a way of this seemingly endless arms race and potential nuclear holocaust. And Kennedy delivers a remarkable speech at American University. It's the commencement address there. It's again during that second week of June, which arguably was the most active week of Kennedy's entire presidency, second week of June, 63. But it's a remarkable address in that for the first time, an American president goes out of his way to celebrate the sacrifices of the Soviet people during the Second World War against the Hitler's Germany. He is just filled with praise about Russian literature, Russian fine arts, et cetera, et cetera. And it really is an extension of an olive branch to Khrushchev, which, by the way, is accepted by Khrushchev. And for the first time in Soviet history, Khrushchev gives the green light for Kennedy's speech to be broadcast to the Soviet people. And so you really begin to see a kind of thawing of the Cold War. And this leads to the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of August, September of 63, which prohibits the testing of nuclear weapons in the atmosphere. I'm firmly of the belief, Bob, that if Kennedy had not been killed in Dallas in November of 63, that this detente would have continued between Kennedy and Khrushchev. But unfortunately, with Kennedy's death in November of 63 and Khrushchev being deposed in October of 64, this brief period of detente comes to an end.
Since we're on the topic of nuclear disarmament, this is as good a moment as any to have you comment on your comparison, Kennedy to Reagan. That's very interesting for obvious reasons. I mean, they were at opposite poles of the spectrum when it comes to their role they thought government should be playing. But I think you identify a couple of ways where, well, one of which is nuclear disarmament. But then in the conclusion of your book, you do a fine job of making the comparison.
Thank you, Bob. Well, I have to say, for my liberal friends, they don't like Kennedy being compared to Reagan. And my conservative friends don't like Reagan being compared to Kennedy.
I'm sure.
So that was one of the more controversial passages in the book. But I think my point stands. As you mentioned, both men shared a deep disdain for nuclear weapons and for the doctrine of mutual assured destruction, which basically held both the United States and the Soviet Union's civilian population hostage in order to keep the peace. But I also think there are ample comparisons to be made between Reagan and Kennedy in terms of their belief in American exceptionalism. Now, that's a phrase that in some quarters isn't particularly popular these days, but they did, I think, view the United States, as Lincoln did, as something of the last best hope of mankind. And you see this belief in Kennedy's speeches, particularly at the Berlin Wall in June of 1963. And I think Reagan's speech at the Berlin Wall in the summer of 1987. And again, both men believed that the United States and the Western way of life was superior to Soviet totalitarianism. And so they shared that view. Now, as you mentioned, Bob, Kennedy had a more activist view domestically of the role the federal government should play. Reagan did not share that view. But Reagan, interestingly enough, gives one of the more, I would argue, moving speeches of his presidency in June of 1985 when he pays tribute to John F. Kennedy. And it's a remarkable speech. It's a fundraising speech for the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. And Reagan grasps the fact that Kennedy shared his view of American exceptionalism, that Kennedy is in a way a symbol of this kind of can-do attitude of the American people. And of course, Reagan believed in that as well. So I do think that's an overlooked aspect that most folks who study either Reagan or Kennedy just don't adequately appreciate.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today, I'm speaking with Stephen Knott, author of Coming to Terms with John F. Kennedy. The book offers a broad view of the young president and shows how politicians on both sides of the aisle distorted JFK's record for their own purposes. Let's talk a bit about Vietnam and the withdrawal of troops that everyone was hoping would happen sometime during the 1960s. Kennedy, of course, built up the advisors that went to Vietnam. The big question, the one that people are still debating to this day, and which you take on in your book, is what would Kennedy have done had he lived and had Lyndon Johnson not taken over from him and significantly expanded the war, bringing more Americans over to fight? Give us your take on how you think that would have worked out.
Well, John F. Kennedy clearly expanded American involvement in Vietnam. When he becomes president in January of 1961, there are about 700 or 800 American military advisors in South Vietnam sent there by the Eisenhower administration. By the time Kennedy leaves office after his murder, that number is up to around 17,000 advisors. So there's a fairly dramatic expansion in terms of the number of American advisors under JFK. But what Kennedy always balked at during his brief presidency was any suggestion, and these suggestions were made to him, that American combat troops begin to pick up the bulk of the fighting. In other words, that the United States actually take over the combat role in South Vietnam. He always refused. And, you know, we know for a fact, due to the fact that many of these meetings were recorded, that Kennedy was often the most skeptical voice in the room when it came to America's role in South Vietnam. Keep in mind that Kennedy had traveled to South Vietnam about 10 or 11 years earlier when he was a member of Congress and spent a considerable time in Saigon, speaking not only to high-level officials, but folks who were literally out in the field. And he came away from that experience, again, with a kind of skepticism towards the ability of any Western power to prevail in South Vietnam. And I think he never forgot the impact of that trip. And the last thing I'll mention, Bob, part of what I think is not appreciated with President Kennedy is this really was an anti-war president. His experience in the Second World War, when he almost lost his life, when two of his crew members did, when a Japanese destroyer hit Kennedy's PT boat, that rocked him. And his letters home to his family during his war years are filled with anti-war sentiment. Now, look, he wanted the United States to prevail, but this is not a person who is a warmonger. And, you know, he's going to lose his older brother, Joseph P. Kennedy, in the Second World War. That also furthers this kind of anti-war sentiment. So I mentioned to you earlier, he took a very hawkish stance on foreign policy in 1960. I think in part that was a campaign tactic, because I think the real man was a man who despised war, who went to great lengths to avoid conflict. And I just don't see him following the same path that President Johnson followed in Vietnam, to the point where you have 550,000 American troops in South Vietnam by 1968. And unfortunately, body bags returning to the United States by the hundreds. I just don't see President Kennedy going down that path.
I'd like to switch gears a little bit here and talk about Kennedy's commitment to put a man on the moon. And I don't ever bring myself into these conversations, but I must say, since it was part and parcel of his New Frontier theme, back to how do we all get into this subject, I addressed my high school graduating class, and the title of the speech was The New Frontier, and it discussed Kennedy's famous line, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And I thought he was talking directly to me. And as I'm reading your book, I'm reading you talk about the Kennedy commitment to land a man on the moon. And it was about a speech he gave at Rice University, but it has so much to do with how an American president can inspire not just his people, but staff, experts, scientists. Please elaborate on that for us. I thought that was a fascinating part of the book that I'm not sure ever occurred to me.
Yeah, Kennedy had this incredible capacity, I believe, to inspire. And I think what a lot of folks don't appreciate is that this was a particularly competitive individual, and he was determined to beat the Russians to the moon. But more than that, Kennedy, again, it's linked to what I said earlier, his belief in American exceptionalism, his belief that the United States could do anything that it put its collective mind to. And he felt in the early 1960s that the American people needed something of a challenge. While there was tension with the Soviet Union, we were prosperous and we were at peace. And Kennedy was concerned that without some sort of overarching goal, something that the American people could literally look up to, that was not a good thing. So he sets this goal of landing a man on the moon before the end of the 1960s. And by the way, he sets it at a time we don't have the capability to do that, not even close. We're just barely getting some of our rockets off the launch pad in Cape Canaveral. So he's setting this remarkable goal. A lot of the experts told him it could not be achieved. And as a matter of fact, of course, we do achieve it. And again, that's part of a kind of larger call, as you put it, his line in the inauguration about, in a sense, giving back to something to your country. In a way, the moon landing project and certainly the Peace Corps were all part of this notion of trying to inspire the American people to look beyond themselves and to give something back to their country. And again, that's an aspect of Kennedy's leadership that I admire, and unfortunately, I think at times it's missing today.
I have two more questions, and this is the tough one. There's one aspect of Kennedy's Camelot that really besmirches his reputation considerably, and it no doubt affected mine over those years when I was trying to figure out what I really thought of Kennedy. And that's, of course, his serial adultery during his presidency. How do you fit that into your overall analysis? This is a tough one.
No, it is a tough one, but it has to be addressed. And it's a very legitimate question. The fact is that he was a serial adulterer. The fact is that he would never, he's never going to win Husband of the Year, if there is such an award. And I'm sure the damage he did to his wife was significant. Now, you can say, well, this was the particular time, the Mad Men era. Kennedy was sort of the Don Draper of his day. but not everybody acted that way. He right. knew it was wrong, and he went to considerable lengths to conceal it. I completely understand, whether it's you, Bob, or some of your listeners who just cannot get past that, in a sense. I have sympathy for that position. I do think personal conduct does matter. And as you said, that's the part of his record that most besmirches his appeal. And I don't sugarcoat it in the book. I guess I would say I came to the conclusion by the end that his public service, the merits of his public service, outweigh this disturbing personal conduct. But again, I'll just leave it up to your listeners. This is a choice that all of us have to make in terms of assessing President Kennedy and assessing his legacy.
Yes, and I think you've given the reader enough evidence that they can make that determination. Let's talk a little bit about the assassination itself. I mean, I think I would be thrown out of this job if I didn't ask you the most important question, which is, okay, Steve, you took a look at more information, books, sources, articles, on Kennedy, on his assassination, than probably anybody else lately. How do you conclude your assessment of whether he, that is Lee Harvey Oswald, acted alone?
Yeah, I'm in a minority of my fellow Americans on this one, Bob. I do believe Oswald acted alone. I understand why people have doubts about that. You know, again, partly due to the revelations later on that the United States under Eisenhower and Kennedy have been trying to assassinate Castro. That fuels some of the conspiracy theories. The fact that Lee Harvey Oswald was murdered within 48 hours of killing President Kennedy, that fuels it. I completely understand why close to two-thirds of the American public believe that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone. Now, in my view, the evidence against Oswald as the lone gunman is overwhelming in that this was a man who had an unbounded imagination and saw himself as a great historical figure. And he actually kept a diary that he called his historic diary, filled with these kind of fantasies about his place in history. He also had another document entitled his Book of Operations. So he saw himself as a secret operative on behalf of Marxism. It's pretty clear that he had taken a shot about 6 months earlier at a retired right-wing general living in the Dallas area named Edwin Walker. That shot just barely missed. But that same rifle that shot at General Walker was also the one found on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, where Oswald worked. Oswald was the lone employee of the book depository who fled the building after the shooting. Everybody else stayed in place. Part of the reason the Dallas Police Department were looking for him is because he had fled the building. We know that six or seven witnesses saw him shoot a Dallas police officer within an hour or so of Kennedy's assassination. So the evidence is, I believe, quite strong. This was a Marine marksman. If you've been to the sixth floor museum in Dallas, that shot was not particularly difficult, particularly for a trained Marine. So again, the evidence is overwhelming, I believe, Bob. Having said that again, I do understand the skepticism of my fellow citizens.
Well, we've run out of time, Steve, but I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Most importantly, thank you for writing Coming to Terms with John F. Kennedy. A high recommend from me to our listeners out there. This has really been a great conversation, and it's even a better book. And we thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Bob. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.